Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Ramp Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ronald J. Martin. Boys, we've got a movie thing to talk about. We've got a restaurant thing and we've got a social media thing. So in that, we are going to do what we always do in that we're going to be all over the map on some of these topics. People have been noticing your silence, Piper, on social media, which must mean you're a prominent person. So we'll get into that and other things right after this quick break.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, boys, we're back. Pipe and Ron, you guys are both prominent figures, very prominent on social media. extremely influencers. You know, people look to you to comment whenever literally anything happens in the world.
Oh, baby, it's so difficult to be looked at like that all the time. You know,
I know you hate being looked at. You know, if there's one thing you hate, it's being looked, it's being gazed at by people.
Yeah, and being objectified for your ideas. I just feel like a piece of social media meat.
Oh, it mars my soul.
Oh, I know. I feel like you would enjoy being objectified a little bit more, you know? Like, over here, everyone, objectify me, you know?
Yeah.
But there's a new phenomenon, Pipe, that you shared with me via text this morning, and I think it's really funny, and I think it's really interesting. I want to pick it apart a little bit. It's the idea of people saying, we notice your silence on social media when you're not commenting on some prominent issue or person, some hot button issue. And this strikes me as them basically saying, I'm disappointed by my inability to like drag you down into the muck and mire with me, which strikes me as the most 2022 thing and the most social media thing ever. And it's full of despair for me. So talk about this a little bit, Piper, how you deal with it. And then I want to hear Ron's response on it as well.
Yeah, it came up most recently this week because of my lack of public commentary on whatever's going on with Matt Chandler. You know, as Ronnie said before the show, we have all the same non-information as everybody else. And and so I just, you know, I just haven't said anything about it. And I think I retweeted something by a person who sort of, they just made a good point about sort of, If you don't have the information and you're not part of it, maybe you don't say anything. And I immediately got a response from some account who I don't follow. I don't really know who it was. It was, you know, it was like, you know, we notice your silence on these issues. And I had a handful of thoughts that ran through my mind. The first was, that's very judgmental, you know, just flat out, just really, I mean, which is comes as no surprise. It's social media. I don't know what I was expecting.
Sure.
I should stop assuming that people are going to graciously interpret everything I do or do not say.
There you go.
And then the latter was like, if you notice my silence, that says a lot about how hard you're paying attention to me, which is weird. Like maybe focus on you. And then the last piece was just what does it say about what our expectations are and the proper way to address anything controversial, anything moral, anything nuanced? I mean, is everybody says social media sucks and there's no nuance, but the expectation is still this must be addressed on social media. So those yeah. are kind of all pinging around in my head while I quietly clicked and muted that account and will no longer hear from that angry person. But so she'll really notice my silence now. I will not notice hers. That I guess that was kind of the array of thoughts was like, you're very judgy. That comes as no surprise. And ranging to, why is this the expectation? What, this is odd. This is just, the whole phenomenon is odd. The whole dynamic is odd. The whole like pinpointing people and being like, if this person doesn't speak out, they have failed society or something like that. I don't know. I don't totally know what to make of it.
Yeah. Ron, what do you make of it? I feel like for me, whenever I notice someone's silence, I'm usually delighted by it. Like, wow, there's one person not talking. I really admire this person more now. But apparently on social media, that's not okay. Where are you at?
Well, you know, yeah, no, I'm with you on that, Big T. Yeah. It's really interesting, right? Because when you if you back up a little bit, you know, social media is in a lot of ways, nobody has, I guess my philosophy about it would be that nobody has any moral obligation on social media in the sense that it can be whatever anybody wants it to be from a personal standpoint. Some guys that only like to tweet funny things. Great, tweet funny stuff. Some guys that are really serious, be serious. Some people that are political, be political. But I don't think that obligates anybody to create a social media presence that then they're judged for if they don't, kind of step up into this, whatever this perceived standard is. It doesn't make any sense. Like, it can be whatever you prefer it to be. So I wouldn't even phrase it that you're being silent on something. It can be whatever you want your social media platform to be or not be. There's just no obligation there. It's technically an amoral platform in that sense. And so it's weird that there's, of course, because it's a thing and this is how we exchange information in news now, there's particular expectations based on the kinds of things that people post. So, you know, something like this happens and we're waiting to hear from the people that talk about the things that like are happening with Matt Chandler, for example. But I just don't, but to go after someone like they did Pipe and say, you're being silent. It's like Piper has no obligation to be any one thing ever on social media that he doesn't want to be. There is no obligation or expectation. There can't be. There's not a book in the Bible that says, and when you get on this platform, you know, this is what is required of you. So yeah. It's just the whole premise of it. It's just ridiculous.
Well, and it seems to me that everyone just superimposes their own kind of moral framework over social media. Like, well, everyone has to be like me. And if they're not, I'm going to destroy them.
And it is so issue specific, because what we have in this instance is a prominent white evangelical pastor having done something, who knows exactly what, that crossed an appropriateness boundary, or at least that was what he apologized for with a woman. So, this is an issue we've seen before. And so since I'm also a white evangelical pastor, this is an issue I'm obliged to speak into. There are other issues that if I responded to, people would be like, maybe you should sit this one out. Probably the same person who told me they noticed my silence. So there is this arbitrary set of rules about what I'm obliged to speak into and what I'm forbidden from speaking into. And all it really makes me want to do is go watch football highlights and tweet jokes, you know, like here's something that made me laugh. And also, Barry Sanders is still the best running back ever. You know, congratulations, Twitter. Yeah. This is my presence.
I feel like it would be fun to be the maybe you should sit this one out guy. So whoever gets to be the sort of arbiter of who gets to talk and sit it out like that, that would be a fun job on Twitter. I don't know, except that
I think you would just go to everybody and be like, I didn't see any neck rolls in this post. You should sit this one out.
Everyone should sit this one out. Yeah. You're all crazy. I'm about to get us off on a tangent. I was reading in Revelation recently.
What? I sent this whole show a tangent? I thought like the whole show is a tangent.
That's called podcast tea.
Yeah, there was something in Revelation that reminded me of social media, and
was it the dragon trying to devour the woman?
Yes, it was some imagery of that sort, and I'm like, this reminds me of social media. Like, this is giving rise to like the worst aspects of literally everyone's character, and maybe this is the thing that's going to like.
Baby, I think develop. Maybe you should sit this one out. I don't know that you should be going to Revelation out. On this and just yeah. desecrating scripture like you're doing right now. I think. It's
oh
time
wow, I'm getting well actually by the small town pastor.
Well, I'm glad you spoke up, Ronnie, because I was noticing your silence there for a moment, and yeah, it wow. was. I was smugly judging you from this.
I mean, I felt obligated as a New Testament Revelation scholar to, you know, speak in
yeah, as so. An almost doctor, almost. Is your persona going to change when you become a doctor?
Oh, it's going to be.
Are we going to?
It's going to be huge. I will not even. I don't even know if I'll respond to you guys on the pod without you addressing me appropriately.
If you don't use the word epistemological at least twice a podcast after earning your doctorate, what are you doing here?
I will still notice your literally silence. Don't know what that means. And yeah, you will have to refer to me as Doc Martin. So that
I'm
going to
become
be
smug now as the only like professional academic on the podcast. You have to become like 33% more a douche. And if you don't, like, I'm going to have concerns, you know, like it's just it comes with it.
You won't survive long in that industry unless you do.
Yeah, you've got to become obsessed with like idiotic little things that don't matter. That's part of it. Yeah, you've got to become even more enamored with your own image. I mean, it's going to be it comes with some requirements, you know, that I hope Jared or somebody's like prepping you for this. Because it's not just getting a doctorate. It comes with all the other stuff.
Dude, so you know, it's so funny. So T, this is like, actually, this is truth. Yeah. So Jared will write me every once in a while and he'll be mm-hmm. like, I hope I'm not getting him busted here, but he'll be like, yeah. Dude, I don't know how you would survive in academia. He goes, I'm like in a meeting right now. And all I'm thinking is this, Ronnie cannot do this. He literally will at one point stand up and do something crazy or storm out. Like he cannot do this. And I'm like, I get these random texts from him every once in a while where he's just like forewarning me against it. Yeah. And I'm like, I don't know, man. I don't get it. That I mean, sound- you I'm know something about that. So I don't know, you know,
that yeah. seems so validating though. Like I don't know. I think if I was in your shoes and I heard that, I'd be like, Oh good. Like this is because yeah. if he was like, oh, this you're gonna do so well, I would feel kind of it would be like
it's almost
so,
a backhanded like,
what has
like,
become
insult.
Of me?
Yeah.
This terrible.
Well, it's usually around stuff that I think he thinks I care about, and I don't necessarily care about some of this stuff like the way people might think. Like, Ronnie, you know, you might have to tuck in your shirt. It's like, dude, I could do that. That wouldn't be the deal breaker for me, you know?
Yeah.
So
it needs
I you
a
know.
Payday, yeah, I can tuck in my shirt, you know. But no, it's
big
the
paydays
it's the,
in academia from everything I've heard, especially
oh, huge,
academia.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, so, I mean, we're with one of them, Pipe. I mean, we're you know, we're with the big payday guy, obviously every week. So you tell
well,
us about
yeah.
it, T.
Yeah, tenured professor Ted Clutch.
Yeah, tenured professor,
rolling
man,
rolling Whoa. In that, rolling in that, Christian education
rolling in that tenured
money.
Professor money, you know,
rolling in piles of money over here. Yeah, it's. Quite a thing. Boys, let's take a break. And then we'll come back and we'll talk about a couple other things. All right, boys, we're back. Piper, you brought this up in the group chat, and sometimes the topic itself is interesting, and sometimes to me, like the reason why you brought it up is interesting, and I want to know who you were with that prompted this. You said can we discuss the psyche of people who like to learn the names of the wait staff at restaurants? I only have one example of this, and it's the movie Tommy Boy in the scene where he's with Helen, the waitress. Yes.
Helen, that's Helen, a nice name.
You look like a Helen. You and I are both in sales.
Let me tell you why I suck as a salesman.
Exactly. That's my only like live rep with this psyche. So I don't
really?
Know a lot of people who do this.
Oh, yeah, you don't hang out with enough like smarmy people.
Which is
funny because you're in academia.
I know. I thought of one more, but I can't talk about it. It would ruin a relationship that I need to maintain. what prompted this for you?
I'm trying to think if it was something. I don't know if it was a particular instance as much as just, I think it was, I saw a social media post from a friend who I've had for a long time and he's about my age
and similar stage in life, similar aged kids, you know, so just a lot of, he works for a Christian nonprofit. So a lot of similarities in what we have done, all that stuff. So he seemed like a good sort of like bizarro version of me in this way, because
yeah.
Let me start out by saying I take being polite to wait staff pretty seriously. Like they're human beings doing a job that really benefits me, and they deserve to be treated with dignity. That being said, I've never asked one their name ever. And this friend is the kind of person, we used to get breakfast pretty regularly, and he would always ask, or if they introduced themselves and he didn't catch it, he'd be like, "I'm sorry, what did you say your name was?" That kind of thing. And
interesting. And he's your age. It's not like he's, you know, 61.
Right. When an old guy does it, there's sort of a like flirtatious charm to it. Because of course they only do it with the females. Like the old guys are never like, "I'm sorry, was your name Steve?" They don't care. They're like,
"No,
sweet tea, please, Steve." And they just sort of roll with it. But then he always addresses the wait staff by name. So, you know, it's some like 19-year-old college student chomping on her gum, and you know, so he's like, "Michaela, I'll have this and this and this." And I'm like, that, I don't know. The whole thing always weirded me out. It
is weird.
Not like morally, but just creepily, I think is kind of what it felt like. I don't understand the psyche of it.
It's oddly familiar, you know, in that, like, in the course of regular day-to-day life, I mean, it's rare that anyone uses your first name. Like, even in our families, we don't use each other's first names. Like, we use nicknames or we just skip the whole thing altogether, but... if KK uses my first name, I know I've done something bad. You know what I mean? Like, I'm
Ted. Oh no.
Ted, I want you to hear me on this. All right. I can count on one hand the number of times she's done that. But, baby, where are you at on this? Are you a first name guy with wait staff, or do you know people who are?
I mean, it always feels, demeaning to me when people do it. It always feels like they're trying to get control of a situation that is like, dude, what are you trying to control here? You know, this man or this woman's going to, you know, serve us, bring us coffee, bring us breakfast, whatever it is. But it feels like two things. It always feels like you're trying to let them know who's boss, which is the weirdest thing in the world to me. Mm-hmm. And number two, it's like this thing where you are trying to look to the people that you're eating with, like you're just a caring, kind-hearted
man of
like individual. Yeah. And it happens a lot with pastors. We've talked about this before, that, hey, is there anything we can pray for you about, you know, as we pray here? And again, nothing quote unquote like wrong with it, other than it just feels wrong, you know? And it's always so uncomfortable to me, because I feel like if I was in their position, they're just trying to do their job. And then I always wonder, like, so, dude, are you the guy then? So when you go get your oil changed, are you like, you know, "Hey, Bill, you know,
do
a great job on my automobile, Bill." Right. You know, I don't know. It always just feels like it's a funny way of interacting with people. And I'm not saying everybody's trying to gain control by it, or there's some deeper psychological thing going on. But it's an odd way to, like, go through life, because you're right, T. I mean... Yeah. To say somebody's first name in a way that's not either like kind of funny or, you know, there's times when it's appropriate to say, like, I just said T, right?
Yeah.
Right. And it was just like, it was part of the way that we interact. But to do it in a way where there's not already a relationship there, it just feels odd to me.
It really does.
You know, like with double K, like when Melissa says, "I don't know, Ronnie," you know, like, it's like, I'm looking at her going, "Are we, like, is this a thing? Are we getting into a thing right now?"
Yeah. No, dude, it's funny. And I want to ask you this as a pastor, both of you. So to your earlier point, it seems like there's this obligation, and maybe this is solely a pastor thing, or maybe it's like an overall cheesy Christian guy thing, to sort of...
That Venn diagram overlaps a lot.
Yeah. To act like you care about everybody. You know what I mean? Whereas for me, let's say, just for a regular person, I would say that, like, genuinely, I want good for everybody. You know what I mean? I don't walk into a restaurant going, "I don't care about this wait staff. I don't care about the rest of these people. I hope bad things happen to them. I hope good things happen to them." But at the same time, there's no obligation for me to indicate that I care deeply about Michaela, or even that I'm remotely interested in praying for her before the meal. You know what I mean? There's no such obligation. But I think for pastors, there's this sense of, I've got to show you that I'm a regular person like you, and then I've got to go one better and show that I, in this moment, I do care about you, where I feel no such obligation. Am I like in the ballpark on that one?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a certain sort of mindset amongst a selection of pastors where they feel like they're pastoring everybody they come across. Yeah. And you know, so for example, on Sunday mornings at church, I meet a new person. I work really hard to learn their name so that if I run across them again in church, I can greet them by name. And there's a sense of like, you're welcome here. You're part of this because that's the context that I'm responsible for. These are people who in this orbit, I have care for, responsibility for, et cetera. Not so at, you know, Applebee's. Like I don't have any responsibility for the Applebee's employees other than as a fellow human. And, but I think a lot of pastors are like, this is my flock, or everybody's a potential part of my flock. And I guess the way that I approach it is I'm like, what I would love is to treat a waitstaff well, to tip well, and to leave. And if at some point down the road, they somehow through 6 degrees of separation discovered that I was a pastor, they'd be like, huh, wouldn't necessarily have guessed that, but he was a nice guy. Like, and no complaints. And just like that would be I would be so satisfied with that. Be like, huh, okay, cool. But the psyche among certain pastors that like, I have to win this person in this interaction about scrambled eggs and bacon. And I'm like, that's, you're overdoing it. You are missing the point of how this interaction goes.
Yeah, because sometimes it just happens, that happens naturally all the time, right? Like you have a table with a bunch of dudes, you get a guy coming in and, you know, you start joking around a little bit and then a natural conversation just arises, but it's not done the way that you're describing it, Pipe, which is just like, I feel this moral or spiritual or pastoral obligation to engage with this guy in a way that's going to make him like super uncomfortable. But yeah, I mean, you can get to know if you're a dude that's going to the same restaurant, you know, twice a week meeting with people. Yeah, you're probably going to get to know the waitstaff for sure.
I'll have the pancakes in the Age of Enlightenment, baby. Hang on, Voltaire. I think the best thing that I always feel like the best thing I can do for Michaela in that moment is be as quick and efficient as possible and as not annoying as possible. And if I'm fast, I can allow her to do something else or take a break or not have to stand there and banter with me. So everybody wins.
Yeah. What they're there to do a job. They're not there to be your friend. And if they do want to be your friend, they show it, you know, like Ronnie said, like sometimes there's particular waitstaff who they love to banter. And honestly, I generally find that annoying. I'm like, I'm here to eat. I'm not here to make friends with you. I don't want to chit chat. I want you to very efficiently take my order and refill my coffee and whatever else. And I promise I will compensate you well for this. That's the agreement that we have. You do
very
your job.
Barnabas Piper of you. Just feed me.
Well, it's a business transaction. I don't need to like win friends and influence people in this interaction. This is not a deal making scenario.
Yeah, not to be that guy, but don't you feel like, and you would have to take a sort of 1,000-foot view of this that we don't have, I guess, but like, I think social media has turned so many seemingly simple interactions on their head in the sense that, you know, people are more connected than ever. People are more achingly lonely than ever. People don't necessarily know how to be with each other in a kind of analog face-to-face environment. I just think a lot of things that we used to take for granted vis-a-vis social interactions have sort of, you know, been made complicated again. You know what I mean? And the whole I notice your silence thing is a part of it, right? So I think people who spend a lot of their lives on social media are so aware of doing the wrong thing in a relational setting that can't help but bleed over into like our real life kind of analog environments in ways that make them weird. And I think I see that on campus and, you know, otherwise.
Yeah, I guess I and then there's the flip side of that where like everything goes viral. So if you're especially awful to somebody, somebody's going to get it on video. Or if you like, people will video themselves leaving a huge tip and then video the waiter's reaction, which feels equally as like that should be a whole separate pod. Like viral kindness is a whole thing I would love to talk with you guys about. But yeah, there's a it does create a different sort of pressure on an interaction that ought to just be innately human, innately kind, and innately like we're both just doing our jobs here.
Yeah, innately low stakes, right? It should be easy. It should be a thing that neither party really has to think about that much.
Yeah, like you shouldn't.
And we need those.
There is no requirement to be memorable to a wait staff.
Yeah.
In fact, if you're not memorable,
yeah, you're probably doing it right, you know?
Yeah, if everybody leaves satisfied, this went well.
Yeah, and you're not, it's not, you know, it's so funny because these guys, you know, wait staffs go through a lot. I mean, honestly, it's like, I mean, they're enduring a lot. They're enduring a lot of weird comments, a lot of, you know, critical comments. So to even just be somebody that is going to treat them kind, not and get, you know, almost like thinking, hey, I don't know what it is you're going through today, but that's actually a bit of a, your job, you have a hard job and you're dealing with people all day. You're dealing largely with unhappy people with your service all day. And even just to give that a little space would, that would be kind-hearted in and of itself, right?
Yeah.
Have you guys ever done the thing? I've been with somebody who did this and it was one of the most awkward situations. So obviously there's people who like to call the manager out to complain. Then there are people who like to call the manager out to compliment an employee. Have you ever been with somebody who's done that?
No. No.
I'm thinking. I don't think I have.
If I have, that was maybe the last time I...
Yeah, I'm never going to eat with that person again for fear of this happening. I have been with somebody who did that where they're like, the waiter or waitress, I don't remember, comes up and they're like, can you get your manager? And the person, you know, they just look like they're crestfallen.
They're petrified. Yeah.
And the waiter, the manager comes out and there's sort of like this big crap-eating grin on the person I'm eating with face. And they're like, we just wanted to say that Steve here has done just a wonderful job tonight. And I'm sure the manager's like, that's great. Also, I was working. Like, we're trying to get payroll done.
Dude, that's so about the performance of the person who's orchestrating.
100%. Right? That's a generational thing too, baby, I think too.
Yeah, they're directing a little movie starring them. They become like Ridley Scott in that moment. And they're like, I'm gonna pull together some elements here and I'm gonna be the star.
Oh, and I can't imagine anyone
blow the thing up.
I can't imagine anybody like under the age of 65 doing that either. Doesn't it just
That'd be
seems
funny
like
if
one
a young
of
guy did it though, wouldn't it? It'd be hilarious. Some young little like, poncy hipster does it at like I don't know, Allergy or whatever the hip, you know, like dining place is.
Allergy, the whole place is just all gluten and peanuts.
Dude, that's my restaurant idea.
Dude, I forgot about that. You talked about that years ago, man. How's that coming? How are plans for Allergy coming along, baby?
It's gonna make millions. It's huge. I'm still fleshing some things out. But no, you go in, you write down a list of your allergies, and they curate like a special.
And they basically serve you nothing. you get a plate of nothing.
Exactly. I'm gonna make millions with that. I'm gonna be a restaurateur. Boys, speaking of things that don't matter and that are already largely forgotten, we're going to take a break and I want to come back and talk about our book a little bit. All right, we're back. Boys, how do you sense that our book is doing out there in the marketplace?
Oh boy.
All I know is that we've been exchanging emails with the same PR company for like 2.5 weeks about one podcast interview. That still hasn't happened yet, to my knowledge. Has that podcast interview happened? Have either of you guys done it?
No. Well, I did the... So they sent one, and it was one that both of you guys were like, I think somebody else should probably take this. I did that one, and it went fine, and it was sort of vaguely about our book and mostly about like doubt and deconstruction. It's a good interview.
Sure.
But yeah, I haven't even responded to those other emails because I'm like, this is the busiest stretch of life for me, and...
Yeah.
I indicated that I would do it. I have two other co-hosts who can very adequately talk, so y'all take this one.
I indicated that I could do it, and then that's the last I heard about it. So the publicity machine is just roaring ahead on our book.
Do you think that we're not getting as many publicity responses because people are like, they're podcast hosts? Like, if we had written this as cultural commentators or as academics or as whatever, like, would there be more PR because it's cultural, you know, it's cultural commentary in print kind of thing, as opposed to like, these are podcast guys who did a book?
That's a good question, and I definitely want to find a reason that isn't no one cares about our book. So this is good. I want to land on one that isn't just another thing that I've done as a massive failure. Ron, what do you think?
I don't know. It's a really great question. I just wonder if the nature of the book, it's obviously for our tribe in, you know, whatever, Christian Booksellers Association, whatever all that stuff is. I mean, it's, you know, there's not a lot of books like it coming out for sure. I mean, we can just say that, you know, that it's not like we're not pumping it up by saying that. It's just kind of a factual thing. And so I always wonder if it's one of those kind of books that nobody really knows what to do with it, and the book speaks for itself in such a way that there's not a lot to talk, you know, unless like what they did with U-Pipe, where they unpack one of the things a little further that we addressed. But yeah. I don't know what is there to say about, you know, what is there to say about something that says everything about what it is by just virtue of reading it, you know? It's there's not a lot of mystery to the book, right? It kind of just says what it says. And so and then I think categorically it's because we're in such a narrow tribe, and you know, everybody needs things to fall into, you know, the few particular categories that we have for things, and this just doesn't. You know, it's a category unto its own. I don't know that anybody would even know what to do with it. And if they like it, they're fans. And if they're more on the influencer side of things, maybe they just roll their eyes. Like, who cares? You know, it just how does this help? In other words, if it's a book that doesn't meet a felt need other than to not take yourself a little seriously and have a good laugh in it, you know, on a Saturday afternoon, I don't know if that's important enough for a lot of people. You know, I don't know.
Did we make the mistake of writing, you know, there are certain kinds of books that when you write it, you're writing it for an audience that needs it, and the audience that needs it will 100% not read it, you know?
Yeah.
Books on not being a jerk as a dad, you know, like there's a defined audience for this. They're not going to read that book. Did we write a book for the reformed world that's based on humor, and like we just, that world doesn't do humor? Like the audience that needs it isn't going to read it.
I mean, I think that's total. I think that's huge right there, Pipe. That's kind of what I was driving at a little bit. I think maybe we did. I think maybe we did do that in a way.
You know? Dude, nobody has misread their audience more times in the history of publishing than definitely me. But maybe the three of us together.
But baby, I got this is my third one with you, so just you can count me in on that, man.
The other two though, I mean,
well, the way a prophet is never without honor as much as within his own tribe. I don't know if that's the exact phrase, but we're gonna go with it.
We'll use it. Speaking of butchering scripture,
can I make a very simple request of our listeners? Obviously, if you haven't bought the book, we would love it if you did that. Buy one for somebody who needs to have a sense of humor. But a super small thing you can do is leave a rating and review on Amazon. You know, we joke about doing that on this podcast periodically. That's nice if you do that, but it actually really helps book sales if there is a kind of a critical mass of ratings and reviews on Amazon. And those of you who have done it so far have written wonderful, amusing reviews, thoughtful reviews, which we don't deserve, lots of 5-star reviews, but that would help us a lot. So, and also just, it would be like a little verbal warm hug for us. So we would appreciate that.
We would appreciate it. And Ronald has gone, Pipe. He's left the program.
He's Irish goodbye yet again.
33 minutes in. He's a very busy individual.
You know,
so
for a half Portuguese guy, he does more Irish goodbyes than anybody I know.
He does. He's got to leverage his half Portugueseness. I think that's the next move for him.
Can I ask you a quick question about, you know, the reception of books? Well, and also the change in reception of books over time. So my last book release. So I did the Ecclesiastes study. That's a different thing because it's kind of sold to churches in bulk. But the last one before that was Hoping for Happiness. It came out right in the middle of 2020. Which was not a great time to release books. There's no speaking right. opportunities to go along with it.
Yeah.
It was one where like I knew when I was writing it, the people who need this most are going to be the least inclined to pick it up, you know, cause but also I think, you know, I think it might be the best book I've written so far. And so like it didn't sell that well. It hasn't sold that well. Yeah. Those who have read it have given good feedback, kindness, et cetera.
Yeah.
So two questions. That book I found not very disappointing in its reception because I knew when it was coming out and I was like, well, pandemic year, no chance to really do a lot of promo around it. So, okay. Mm-hmm. Also, the audience I'm writing for is not likely to just snap this thing up because the people who need it are manically pursuing other things. So, so I wasn't that disappointed. So how do you navigate the kind of expectation disappointment aspect of releasing a book? And second, how has the feedback loop on books changed in the last, I mean, because you've been writing for like 20 years. How has the feedback loop changed in terms of like gauging how a book is being responded to?
Yeah, no, that's really good. Those questions. I think when I first started publishing books, that would have been, I think, 2005. My first book came out 2005, 2006. That was really under the old paradigm, right? So like with that one, I did a couple of like in-store signings. I did a bunch of, this was for Facing Tyson. So I did a bunch of appearances on like, you know, Scranton, Pennsylvania sports talk radio, you know, whenever some like local radio station would request, I would do it. So there weren't podcasts obviously back then. Blogs were a thing, but they weren't taken very seriously. So it was a real kind of, you know, old paradigm experience. But now, so like my last couple books, like real books that were just like me that, or that were just by me that released, were these graphic novels for kids. And I did them with Harvest House, which is the publisher of our book. They didn't really do any marketing. So like all those marketing meetings that we had for the Happy Rent book, I think we did zero marketing meetings for my kids' books. And it was just sort of understood that they wouldn't be doing any marketing. And they held up that end of the bargain. And as a result, the response that I got was everybody that read them loved them. And there was a lot of word of mouth and people were really fired up about them. But that was a relatively small group of people. So, and I think one other function of this that's bad is just my own cynicism. Like having been in the industry for almost 20 years.
No.
Yeah, me? I know, shocker. But in this case, it's working because it does act as a hedge against unrealistic expectations, right? Because I think, you know, when I was south of 30 doing my first book or around 30 or however old I was back then, there was a sense that, oh my gosh, this is going to be a rocket ship and somebody's going to want to make a movie about it. And I just had all these grandiose kind of delusions of grandeur in my own mind about myself that, you know, that were fun. Like, it's fun to feel that way. It really is kind of a blast, but it's also stupid because then you get massively disappointed when the thing inevitably doesn't happen. So I would say now it's almost all about, am I satisfied with the work that I've done? And if the answer is yes, then I feel good about the book. Like, I really feel good about it if I'm satisfied with what I've done. And that's, to me, a better way to do it. Does that make sense?
It does, yeah. And I tend to agree with you on the satisfaction with work. I think I'm, you know, things tend to kind of come around in like circles. So I worked in publishing when I released my first book, so I had a pretty good idea of how things did and did not work. And so I didn't have higher expectations than I should have. I kind of knew where I fell as an author, et cetera.
Yeah.
And then, and so I wasn't caught off guard by not New York Times bestselling. But it's gotten to the point now where I'm like, there's almost a kind of open-handed shrugging frustration because it's like, how in the world do you let anybody know about your book? You know, publishers don't have the power to do that. They can't make a book a bestseller. There's a, you know, we have a podcast, which is a better platform than most authors have. Social media doesn't sell books unless there's a critical mass of people all lauding the same book. Like, there's a book that came out, I don't know when it came out, but in the last 6 months, I've seen 25 people, 100 people that I respect say that this book called Everything Sad is Untrue. And they're like, this is one of the best things I've ever read. And at some point I was like, I should buy this book because everybody says it's great. So you can reach that level of acclaim. But with a book like The Happy Rant, Hoping for Happiness, your graphic novels, which are, they're kind of like the Diary of a Wimpy Kid style books. Really fun reads too. I just sort of go, this is out there, but like, unless somebody finds it in some dusty corner of the internet and realizes maybe this is great and they start to tell all their friends, then nothing's going to happen with this.
Yeah. Yeah. And publishers must know that. but the more I'm involved in publishing, the more I, at a deep level, I realize no one knows how to sell a book, right? Even publishers, you know, we sit in these marketing meetings and also you see them putting dollars and effort behind the wrong projects, right? Like, you know, I feel like there have been many times, even with books that I'm a part of, where I'm like, you guys know there's no way this is selling. So get what you can out of it and move on, probably. But it's a funny industry in that I almost can't think of any other industry where people keep doing it while having no idea really how it works. You know what I mean? Like, we live in sort of the heat and humidity belt. And as a result, like, lawn care is a really great industry. People know exactly how it works. And they know that there's like a 9-month swath of the year where you can make a huge pile of money, like cutting people's grass and trimming their
hedges. And everybody's a repeat customer because the grass needs to be mown 7 times a week.
That's it. So that's an industry that, like, everybody involved in it has like a real strong working knowledge of how this works, what it takes. Whereas publishing, it's just like, let's do this book about fill in the blank, you know, and we'll make bookmarks and we'll set up a dedicated landing page for it. And it's like, you're doing that knowing full well that it doesn't work. You know, that's the same thing you did for your last 5 books, and it didn't work then.
Much of that has to do with, I mean, I will go a little easy on publishers here because publishers used to be culture shapers or trend shapers. Yeah. So, you know, a huge house, they would not put out, you know, a huge publishing house. I think it's funny that they call them houses that, you know, that's so old school and sort of quaint. Really, they're, you know, multimedia conglomerations. But you know, publishing house wouldn't put out that many books. We're talking 40, 50 years ago. And when they did, they had entire avenues of promotion. We can get this in the front of bookshops all over the country. There was thousands of bookstores. And the publishers owned that conduit. They could create a novelty, you know, around a book, around a book release. That changed with the dawning of the internet. The other thing that has changed with the dawning of the internet is the pace of ideas. So unless a publisher can put out a book in 72 hours, they can't keep up with what people are interested in. And so publishers have not, and I don't know how anybody would, so that, again, this is not a knock on them, been able to figure out, like, what is a book that's going to matter in 9 months when this is released? Or 18 months from the time we sign the contract. Because we sign the contract, then there's 9 or 10 months of writing. Then there's 9 or 10 months of production, which is absurd, but that's where we're at.
Yeah.
And the answer is, I don't know. Good, you know, a memoir or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, all of that is the case. The only thing that stands out among... There are two ways to sell books that I can see. One is to sell books, which means be John Grisham, be David Baldacci, be... I don't know, pick your favorite, Rachel Hollis, like having it.
Yeah.
They sell books because they have sold books. Like there's a critical mass around that. The other is to have a virality to your fandom. People read it and they cannot help but talk about it.
Mm.
And which is different than people reading it and liking it because and so, you know, you saw that. I think the first time I was aware of that was The Help. What was her name? Catherine Stockett, something like that.
Yeah.
It was a debut novel that they didn't do a big print run on, but it got into like the book club scene and blew up and then became a film and all this. And same thing with like this Everything Sad is Untrue. It's kind of going the same route. And, you know, Where the Crawdads Sing is another one that was like, really, I mean, it's a great novel, but like it has something like 100,000 ratings on Amazon.
That's crazy.
Bonkers. So like the vibe, neither of those two things are controllable by the author or the publisher.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of where we, like, say you're asking, how is our book doing? It's like, well, not that.
Definitely not that.
You know, and you can't generate that. Well, we can ask all of our listeners to like buy it, rate it, review it, talk to friends, what's that, et cetera. But like, you know, what is that going
to
move?
Honestly, the closest I've gotten to that was when Why We're Not Emergent came out, which was 06 or 07. And Moody got it included in like the gift bags at Together for the Gospel. So I don't know how many people went to Together for the Gospel that year. I don't know what, like 1,000 pastors or maybe 5,000.
It was probably between 2 and 5 at that point.
Yeah. So let's say 3,000 pastors got it for free in their book bag. And I remember thinking when they did that, wow, you're going to give away 3,000 free copies of this? Is that smart? You know, like those people might potentially have bought it. But it ended up being the smartest thing because all those people, this was at the height of the blogosphere when every pastor on earth had like, you know, the Books and Coffee blog with a banner image of a steaming cup of coffee next to a pile of books, right? Every pastor had that in 2007. And so they all went home from Together for the Gospel with their little bag of free books and read it and blogged about it. And that ended up being the best possible piece of marketing that we could have gotten. So ever since then, I've been sort of not aggressive because I'm never aggressive with a publisher, but I've kind of been like, huh, I wonder if we could get the graphic novels like given out at like a mom conference or, you know, some creative thing like that. And, you know, it never really has happened since, but that seemed to work well.
But yeah, even that, and this is a little industry deep dive, the marketing budgets for books are crap now. In 2006, your book, you know, I bet they anticipated it selling 5,000 to 10,000 copies. I'm guessing, I don't know what the advance was, but I'm guessing that those two numbers correspond pretty well. And then that means the marketing budget for at that point was probably $10,000 to $15,000.
Yeah.
And then maybe they made an exception to give it away, but like $15,000 in 2006 was a measurable amount of money. You could do a decent amount of advertisements and things like that. PR was a thing that was a lot bigger then in terms of interviews.
Yeah.
Now the marketing budgets haven't changed. So, you know, a $10,000 marketing budget now is one ad, which doesn't move any books. Or the publishers can't afford to give away 5,000 to 6,000 copies of a book because that's, you know, their
paper's expensive.
Paper's expensive. Hard to get. You know, that's if they gave away 5,000 copies, that's probably $10,000 to $15,000. And so even that reality has shifted. I was telling my wife the other day, just kind of being grumpy about marketing budgets and our book. And I just said, you know, I said, I'm guessing their marketing budget for our book was like $8,000 to $10,000. And honestly, they should have just split it between the three of us because we do all the marketing for it. And
dude, they should have.
You know,
yeah, that would have been great.
And I kind of wish publishers would do that. They're like, how about we don't promote your book at all, but we take the money we would have put into it and we give it to you in your advance.
Yeah, that'd be nice.
And I'm like, all right, well, it's not going to cost them anymore. It's less work for them. And I'm going to be doing all the work anyway. So yeah, let's do that.
Yeah. Yeah. No, it's a great idea. The business has really changed. And I'm really glad I caught the tail end of like the kind of cool old school publishing paradigm with like radio shows and in stores and stuff like that. I'm glad I got to like experience that because it's the kind of thing I see it in movies and I'm like, oh, that looks romantic. That looks cool. It's more than just like, hey, it's Tuesday, craft a tweet about your book again, you know, which isn't nearly as sexy and romantic.
Well, yeah, but. And it gets tiresome. Like probably 3-4 times a week, I think, what could I post about our book to kind of keep it in keep it in the the eye of people who follow me? And the answer is, I don't know. I've run out of stuff. Like, I can't keep saying, just hey, this exists. You know?
Yeah. Dude, you know what you ought to do? You ought to take a snapshot of, like, the thing where I go, like, a paragraph and a half on John Wayne and why he's great, and put that out. That would probably rile a bunch of people up.
Yeah, and if you had Twitter, I would totally do that and tag you. Be like, look what Ted wrote. But instead, I have to deal with all the "we see your silence" or, you know, you,
that's true,
you bigoted monster.
Yeah, never mind. I take that back.
Yeah, I'm not taking your heat. That's on you.
Exactly. That's the worst of all worlds. It's like, it's not even my own heat, you know? Pipe. We've done what we always do on this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout some topics and then ended up complaining about publishing, which is one of my favorite things to do. And until next time.
We want to take a moment to thank the team at Life Audio for partnering with us on this podcast. Be sure to go to lifeaudio.com and take a look at the other podcasts in their network. They've got shows about prayer, Bible study, parenting, and more.
This is Perseus Poku, host of the Sound Reasoning Ministry podcast. Learn how to share and defend your faith by listening to us weekly. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com.